Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. But first, art as an act of resistance and as a weapon to counter oppression and violence. With us is Mark Levine. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine and the author of Overthrowing Geography, Heavy Metal Islam, and Impossible Peace. Well, welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Mark Levine. It's great to have you back with us.
Wonderful to be there.
You have written this piece about art as a weapon of resistance, particularly in certain times, and you use this Nigerian artist sort of as the lead-in to give us an example. Could you remind us of who this artist is and how this illustrates your point?
You mean Fela Kuti's art?
Yes.
Well, the inspiration for the research I've been doing the last 5 years really was Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti is probably the most important popular music artist in the 20th century in Africa. He was, you know, not only the most famous musician in Africa in the, you know, in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and he was based in Lagos in Nigeria, but he also was by far the most political artist perhaps in the world. He came to the U.S. in the late 60s, was introduced to the Black Panthers, and became highly politicized. He came from a political family himself and came home and just made a series of albums with and songs with titles like Zombie, Thief Thief, No Agreement, and the list goes on and on, each one more political than the next. And this is against the government, a Nigerian dictatorship, which was one of the most brutal on earth, and which in the late 60s had engaged in a genocidal war against the Biafran people. I'm sure many of your older listeners remember the Biafran War, which killed, just to put it in perspective, it killed 3 million people in the same time that the Syrian civil war has killed about 200,000. Mm. So it was on a whole other level of death and destruction. And he was willing to take on this government directly, and he coined a phrase which really moved me and which I put on the front cover of my book, Heavy Metal Islam, which was that music is the weapon of the future. So Fela Kuti, you know, had this idea of music as the weapon of the future, although for him it was actually a weapon of the present, and it cost him dearly. At one point, the Nigerian military raided his home, threw his mother out the second-story window and killed her. And rather than being cowed, he took his mother's coffin and marched it to the home of the president and took a photo of it and wrote a song called Coffin for Head of State, which then also became the title of one of his albums. So that's the kind of person he was. And he was truly one of the great artists in African musical history, certainly modern musical history. And this really inspired me as I was, you know, working with artists in the Arab world and Iran and Pakistan and Turkey in the late 90s and 2000s, and starting to see their musical scenes being politicized, especially rock music, hip-hop, these kinds of musics. And once the revolutions broke out across the Arab world, it really became clear how important music was, and that it had become not a music of the future, not a weapon of the future, but a weapon clearly of the present. And in fact, I was in Nigeria again, in the Niger Delta, which has suffered such devastation from oil spills and other environmental damage of the petroleum industry. And I was talking to a young rapper named MCK, literally along the riverbank of one of the most devastated rivers in this place called Ogoniland, the Ogoni Kingdom. And he was saying the same thing. We were talking about Fela, who, of course, is an inspiration for any young Nigerian artist. And he was saying the same thing, that music, you know, it really has become the weapon of the present. It's the only weapon that young artists have left, music, art, poetry, etc. So that's the kind of work that I've been trying to focus on, to study and collaborate with these artists who are really at the edge of intense social and political and economic conflict, and who are trying to use this art not just as a weapon of resistance against authoritarian regimes or corruption or, you know, exploitative corporations like oil companies, but also as a tool of creating new communities and new solidarities that are very important for long-term struggle.
Now, one of the things you noted in the article was that some of these regimes have really tried to suppress and oppress art and music in some pretty heinous ways as well.
Well, I mean, if you look at the revolutions in the Arab world, let's just start with them. You know, some of my friends, for example, the Moroccan rapper Al-Haqid, have been jailed multiple times, beaten, tortured, you know, denied their rights, clearly on trumped-up charges, framed for crimes they clearly didn't commit. In Egypt, artists have been, again, tortured, beaten, forced into exile. In Syria, artists have had their hands smashed, their throats slit, depending on what kind of art they do. So a sculptor might have his hands smashed. A singer and poet had his throat slit, obviously killed. You know, in Mali and in other places where ISIL-like groups have been running rampant the last few years, artists have been stoned and killed, and, of course, musical instruments destroyed. So it's you know, artists have suffered, you know, severe threats, not just musicians, although as a musician, those are the people I most focus on, but writers as well are under severe threat. And especially these days, whether you're in Africa or in the Middle East, which are the two places I look at, you don't know who's going to get you first. Is it a repressive government or, you know, or a violent, religiously based insurgency? And sometimes it's both, especially in a place like Syria. You really are at the mercy of you don't know who. Libya is similar. So it's really become almost unprecedentedly difficult to be an artist that is trying to work for social and political change today.
And you mentioned the religious groups as well. Part of your point in that article had to do with how religion and music, at their best, really have this transcendent quality. But then there's this kind of competition as well. How would you describe that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, one of the things I realized when I was, this I realized around 2004 when I was in Iraq. I was in Iraq after the U.S. invasion doing research as far away from the green zone and the embedded kind of scholars and reporters as possible with, you know, interviewing insurgents and religious leaders and just trying to understand in an unfiltered way what was actually happening in Iraq. And I realized quickly that most of these people that I was supposed to be interviewing were very boring. And in fact, I could pretty much write down what they were going to say before they even said it, because they had a very narrow kind of company line that they would repeat. And the most interesting people, who were always surprising me, were, of course, the artists who I'd meet at night in cafes or people's homes or very occasionally a performance somewhere. Underground performance, and that's when I really, you know, became aware of the fact that rather than just focusing on the usual suspects, I could actually learn a lot more about what was going on in a place by hanging out with the people I enjoyed being with, which was the artists. And as I got to know more and more artists, I became friends with a very well-known singer and guitarist named Salman Ahmed from the band Janoon, which is perhaps the most popular at its heyday in the 90s, was the most popular group in the world east of Istanbul. They are a Pakistani rock band that sold 30 million albums and, you know, were very, very well known across Asia. And he did a wonderful documentary for MTV called The Rock Star and the Mullah, where he traveled around Pakistan with his guitar and would go to madrasas and mosques and play music and challenge the imams and you know, these kind of very, very extreme, conservatively religious madrasas to understand that music was not prohibited, essentially in the Quran. That was a human decision, not one that was dictated by God. And, of course, he received all kinds of death threats and attacks because of it. But he said something really interesting to me. He said, you know, the reason they don't like us is because we are their competition. Because in the end, you know, rock and roll and intense, beautiful music that is liberating for young people is a direct competitor in a situation of hopelessness with a kind of nihilistic but also extremely intense and emotionalized and highly effective religious practice. And he wasn't the only one who said this. Even in Iraq, I would meet especially one young religious sheikh who was very progressive, who we had a long discussion about rock music, and he said the same thing. You know, when we as religious people are marching and pumping our fists on our chest and chanting and pumping them in the air and banging drums. He said, we're doing heavy metal too. It's the same thing. It reaches the same place. So it became clear that, you know, music and religion, which of course have gone together since the beginning of both, also, depending on who's doing it, can be directly competitive. And that is why I think in so many places where you have these extreme religious movements, they are very against any kind of music that they don't control. It's not necessarily that they're against music, because most of them have their own music. But any other kind of music, especially a so-called secular music or a Sufi music, which is not advocating violence, can direct people's attention and their loyalty away from this very extremist path, and so they are a threat. And that also is something you have to take into consideration when you're studying these kinds of movements, how music and religion, or art and religion, intersect and compete at the same time.
So these are a couple of the forces that you've been studying, and you brought in some other forces in this article that were also interacting with the politics and the music and the religion, and that was globalization, neoliberalism, colonialism. How do these interact with these other forces?
Well, first of all, I think we need to also talk about, you know, what the definition of religion is, right? My definition of religion, I follow Paul Tillich, the great Protestant theologian, who basically described religion as whatever is of ultimate concern to a person. And I think that much broader understanding of what religion is allows for us to understand why something like music, or of course a seemingly irreligious or non-religious ideology like communism or, you know, worshiping money or whatever, can also fulfill the same function sociologically, psychologically, spiritually, epistemologically, or phenomenologically as religion. So that kind of broader understanding of the role of religion, I think, is very important for us to bear in mind. But, these other forces, I mean, globalization, or what we would call today neoliberalism as the form that globalization takes, of course, is almost overdetermines the way art gets done today. It does so in a negative way, on the one hand, because the new technologies, the internet and social media and satellite TV and mobile phones, allow for an inundation of local cultures by the globally dominant Western cultures. This was something that was a huge threat, again, to critics of the West, especially to religious conservatives. Of course, even in France, they were very scared of this and took a lot of measures in the 90s to try to protect France and French culture and language from globalization and what they thought was going to be Americanization. So it's not unique to the developing world or to the Muslim world. It's happened in many other places in the so-called first world or the developed world as well. But it also, you know, I think the focus that a lot of people have given to the negative components of globalization, especially culturally, overshadow what in fact are the many positive dynamics. And for, you know, so many people in these cultures, they have fully indigenized these other cultural forms that travel through and travel in. And in fact, American culture has not necessarily been the dominant form. We see all over Africa and the Arab world, Bollywood being extremely important. We see Japanese culture being very important, everything from manga to anime and other forms that have taken root elsewhere. And you know, all cultures, no matter how much people want to claim a specific culture as pure or as their own or as indigenous or autochthonous to a specific place, of course, in reality, culture is extremely hybrid. There is no pure culture. That's essentially, a fiction. And so most people have adapted culture continuously going back thousands of years and done so very happily and with great affect and with great effect. So, you know, culture has had a lot of, you know, it's been one of the most positive, in some places the only positive, impact of globalization. Just to give you an example, again, a couple of weeks ago I'm standing in the Niger Delta with a young rapper who pulls out a song on his cell phone that he just wrote on his computer with his partner, a computer that 10 years ago would have cost, you know, innumerable thousands of dollars, way beyond the reach of any young person in his part of Nigeria, in a poor fishing village in Nigeria. And, you know, with a software downloaded for free from the internet, they recorded a song which sounds as good as any song recorded by, you know, professionally for thousands and thousands of dollars. And the song was uploaded onto the internet and circulated for free and was a hit, a local hit. And it was a very political song. The song was called January Money, and it was about the corruption that plagues his region in the Niger Delta and has prevented the proper cleanup from the oil spill. And all of these technologies and this ability to produce, disseminate, and consume culture freely, essentially, from anywhere to anywhere, is one of the most amazing blessings of globalization. It has helped create communications across, you know, not just the cultural divide, but continental divides. So culture, neoliberalism, while the economic impact is certainly negative for most peoples, especially peoples in the developing world or in the West, if you're not part of the 1% or 2%, it also offers tools of resistance and transcendence that weren't available decades ago, even a few decades ago. So those who are most active on the ground are cognizant of this and are trying to use the tools that neoliberalism has provided, in the sense that it doesn't necessarily weaken states, but it shifts the way power operates in states and does offer some new forms of resistance, even as it offers new forms of repression for states. And the battle, you know, as Gramsci, of course, told us what happened, the war of position just shifts constantly to new terrain. And, you know, those who are at the forefront of pushing for cultural change are you know, the real warriors today. They are the ones who are really helping to produce, to keep the battle going, even though the odds are so stacked in favor of those who have state power or the power of capital behind them. And that's, you know, that's what gives me hope.
One of the things you also wrote about was the specific art in Tahrir Square and how partly the protest itself was a form of art, and that it was helping to create this solidarity and perhaps giving hope to a generation. And this was in the face of the oppression. So what would you, you describe this?
Certainly, Tahrir Square was perhaps one of the world's largest ever installation art pieces when it was really cooking. You know, when you'd go in there, and I was lucky enough to be there for much of the revolution, the January 25th revolution, you would just be bombarded with every kind of aesthetic product imaginable. You would hear drums banging, people singing, people chanting, posters everywhere, photos everywhere, cartoons everywhere, people, you know, delivering speeches, movies being shown on sheets from, you know, cheap projectors and you know, stages every 10 or 12 meters with someone else singing a different kind of music, and just on and on, and everyone videotaping and then producing their own videos, and they get disseminated, and it was overwhelming. You know, by the time you'd spend 7, 8, 10, 12 hours a day in Tahrir, your head was swimming. And that is what made Tahrir impregnable, in a sense. As long as there was that much art, it meant there were that many people, and as long as there were that many people, the government could not just start bombing or killing or shooting. That was absolutely the key. So art was central to the power of Tahrir Square at that moment, and perhaps the most important space in Tahrir to me, which hardly anyone has written about, was right outside, ironically, the KFC restaurant. There's a couple of Western fast food places in Tahrir, KFC and Hardee's. And the KFC had something called the Revolutionary Artists Union located outside, which was a section of the square, maybe 10 meters by 10 meters, where all the artists came to do their art and put it up and do caricatures, and poets would come and do poetry, musicians would come and do music. And it was just, and this was 24 hours a day, it was just an absolutely, you know, enthralling place as an artist to be. And I met many wonderful people I still stay in touch with there. But art on its own can't lead. I don't want to romanticize the power of art. Art is a very strange thing because it both reflects and can help lead movements of change, but it can't do it in the absence of the people who are there who have to be in the physical space to make it work. So gradually, over the next 2 years, as the revolution slowly lost momentum and Tahrir began to be filled with other people, with Salafis and Muslim Brotherhood members, and then pro-military people finally with the coup in 2013, the art essentially disappeared. And, you know, the last time Tahrir was occupied in any meaningful sense around the, which was by the pro-coup people who thought they were engaged in a new revolution, but most were duped. The reason you knew they were going to be duped, if you knew how to look, was because there was simply no art there, except for banners supporting Sisi, supporting the military, and a very ugly and ramshackle little museum in dedication to Gamal Nasser, the famous leader of the 1952 coup, who led Egypt from then until 1970 when he died, and you know that utter lack of art. And the fact that the great art and music that was being produced was suddenly replaced by really cheesy music and cheesy art in celebration of the very military against whom people revolted 2 years earlier demonstrated, you know, how far Egypt had descended from the height of the revolutionary period. So I think art, you know, becomes both a kind of canary in the coal mine for the revolutionary pulse, but it also has a synergizing and amplifying effect. And the more that's there, the more it helps solidify and increase a revolutionary moment, which then generates more art. So it's a very useful tool of analysis, but you need very finely calibrated intellectual instruments to correctly understand its role and power.
Mark Levine, before we let you go now, if you could give us a bit of update, because you've been traveling quite a bit. You mentioned that you'd been in Nigeria and Kenya and Sweden, but also Tunisia. And you had posted on your Facebook page about some of the refugees that you had crossed paths with in airports and in other settings, one in particular who wanted to show you a video on his phone of ISIS executing his brother.
Yeah, this was very tragic. This was in Malmo, in southern Sweden, which is right across the strait from Copenhagen. It is basically the point where hundreds of thousands, or tens of thousands at least, of refugees have entered Sweden, one of the main places. Some come overland in the north, but that's very rare. Most have come through Germany, and then into Denmark, and then the train into southern Sweden. And, you know, some days, and Malmo is third or fourth biggest town in Sweden, but it still means it's only a few hundred thousand people at most. You know, it's getting as many as 1,700 people a day showing up. And you know, the way the Swedes have handled this is just amazing and inspiring. Nevertheless, you know, at 12:30 at night, if sometimes I wander in to see what's happening, and there'll be 100, 200 people still sleeping there because there's simply nowhere for them to go. They can't move anywhere yet, and you know, it's a safe space. It's dry in the train station, and there are people there from various volunteer organizations who help find housing, and the government who help lead them to processing centers. But it takes time, and I met one family there, a man who was there with his daughters from Mosul. And, of course, Mosul was taken over by ISIS a year and a half or so ago, and they killed anyone who was an activist in the most brutal way. And he, according to him, I don't know if this is true, you know, was in Mosul a very wealthy person who owned several gas stations and such. And to punish him for not supporting them, they basically killed his brother in front of him. And, you know, he pulled out his cell phone and wanted to show this me, and of course I didn't need to see another execution video by ISIL, and he understood. But, you know, he keeps it with him because that's his story. And obviously when he finally gets to a refugee processing center, as an Iraqi, he is not guaranteed immediate asylum, whereas any Syrian who gets to Sweden has essentially been promised asylum. They are the only ones, though, and a lot of people don't understand that. So, in fact, most of the people arriving are Afghans, the majority of whom will probably be sent back to Afghanistan. The rest are Iraqis, and if you don't come from one of the parts of Iraq that are under ISIL control right now, like Mosul or Ramadi or Fallujah, Sulaymaniyah maybe, you will be sent back too, because they simply can't handle everyone coming in, and really Syrians are the only ones who get in. But because he's from Mosul and because he has this video and other evidence, he'll probably get asylum in Sweden. I met people from Eritrea, people from Egypt. You know, everyone is coming right now because they think they can, and some are clearly war refugees. Some are not war refugees, but they're political exiles. I'm working with, you know, a young man I met there from Syria. While he's Syrian, he's from Damascus, and he wasn't really under immediate threat from Damascus. So he really isn't a refugee, but he came because he had the chance to come. He took a very arduous boat that could have killed him, like we've seen with so many people, but he made it. And, you know, now he has a job, he's learned Swedish, he's restarted his life, and he spends his nights volunteering at the train station to help other refugees. So the stories are absolutely amazing, but it also forces us to reconsider, what is this whole mass movement of peoples? You know, why do we think that a refugee is so different from an economic migrant? You know, why is it that the Swedish government is letting in anyone who comes from Syria, even though not all of them were under immediate threat of death, while EU migrants, as they call them, basically Roma coming from Hungary or Romania, are being kicked out, you know, because they're only, quote-unquote, economic migrants. But, of course, they are there because of policies and neoliberalism and changes in the world economy and the European economy that have, you know, made it impossible for them to have a normal life where they came from. So, you know, we need to really reconceptualize this idea that there's a difference, such a basic difference between economic and war-related migration. And, of course, in America, it's the same thing. The millions of people coming from Central America who Donald Trump wants to kick out, you know, most of them come because their economies were decimated by U.S. policies and U.S. wars, or U.S.-sponsored wars, which we put billions of dollars in and led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, we have a responsibility to these people who then come to us because we destroyed their economy. So, again, we really need, whether it's in Europe or in the U.S., we need to reevaluate and come to a new understanding of what it means to be a migrant or a refugee. And this is, you know, really the cost and the reality of neoliberalism in the real world in the beginning of the 21st century. So that, I think, is a message that, you know, obviously politicians will not deal with, but on the ground we have to deal with it, and we have to come to terms with it as a country here and as a continent in Europe.
Well, Mark Levine, what a pleasure it is to have you back on the program.
Always happy to be with you.
And I'd love to continue this part of the conversation in a coming week as well, because there's obviously so much there. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Citizens in other states have begun a movement to call for a constitutional convention. What is the likelihood of these occurring? And what are the various processes that others have used in past amendments? We'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. We have three constitutional experts with us. Sanford Levinson joins us. He is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, our undemocratic constitution, where the constitution goes wrong and how we, the people, can correct it, and more recently framed America's 51 constitutions and the crisis of governance. Also with us is John Vile. John Vile is dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Also with us is Stephen Griffin. He is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Let's start with the process of amending the U.S. Constitution. What is the likelihood of an amendment succeeding? Stephen Griffin?
I would just point out that in talking to John and Sandy, you're talking to two of the greatest constitutional amendment mavens in the country. Maybe it would be surprising to some, but there is somewhat of a latent consensus in the country that some kind of fundamental political reforms should be made. That doesn't mean people agree, of course, but it also doesn't mean that amendment is the only way to get there. Now, because of Citizens United, that has highlighted the issue of some decisions, the Supreme Court decisions, you can only overturn through amendment. But that's not really true of all of them. The constitutional system can work in funny ways. The general observation I would start with is that the traditional graveyard of constitutional amendments is not the states. It's Congress. You have thousands of amendments, and we only have very few passed on to the states. And most of the amendments that have been passed on to the states have been ratified. So the big graveyard here is the supermajority rule. That's in Article 5, that requires a supermajority of the House and the Senate for any amendment to go forward.
Sandy Levinson, you have been very critical about Article 5. Why don't you put this into context for us?
You're absolutely right. Not to put too fine a point on it, I despise Article 5 because it makes it, as a practical matter, next to impossible to amend the Constitution with regard to anything that is controversial, and some people might argue even with regard to things that are genuinely important. There is no conceivable scenario under which two-thirds of the House and the Senate will vote to overrule Citizens United, which has this very strong support of almost all Republicans, just as Republicans generally have been cheerleaders for all of the cases that have gutted campaign finance reform. So I think that whatever one's views on the substance of Citizens United, it really is like throwing a message into the ocean and expecting that somebody on the other side will find it.
John Vile?
I wouldn't quite go that far. Let's start with some facts. We have 27 amendments. Steve was exactly right. We have about 12,000 proposals that have been introduced in Congress. 33 were actually proposed to the states. 27 of those were ratified. So he's absolutely right. The Congress, and particularly the Senate, is sort of the graveyard for amendments. I suppose a defender of the current decisions in the Supreme Court might argue that this is actually a testament to the power of the First Amendment, which, once adopted, takes on a life of its own and is very difficult to amend. We've only had one amendment repealed. I would say the only amendment that has significantly reduced civil liberties, the 18th Amendment, has been subsequently repealed. The other side of this is that there are some people who believe that speech and money are closely tied and are very grateful to have a system where the government cannot, and particularly where incumbents in office who tend to perpetuate themselves and for whom we do not have term limits other than for the president, often have a tremendous advantage over challengers. And I think there are many who think that the Supreme Court has actually been in the right direction.
Let's back up and do a little bit more historic context then. You've given us some numbers. How hard has it been historically to pass these 27 amendments? Were some of them not as hard? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Sandy Levinson?
I think that the easy ones to pass are where the country realized, or those actually in charge of state legislatures realized that they made a great deal of sense. One of my favorite amendments that is almost never taught because there's no litigation about it is the 20th Amendment. The 20th Amendment is a great, great addition to the Constitution. It moved up Inauguration Day from March 4th to January 20th because I think by 1933 everybody agreed that it was crazy to have this five-month period between election and the inauguration of a new president who might very well have defeated an incumbent. So, in effect, we really didn't have a functioning government for several months. I'm very critical of keeping January 20th, but still, we got rid of March 4th. The other thing the 20th Amendment did was to get rid of what we now realize was a lunatic feature of the Constitution in terms of its practical operation. And in fact, this even came up in the recess appointment case, that under the original Constitution, Congress met only once a year in December. And so you could have literally 13 months go by between the election of the new Congress and the first time the new Congress, as against the lame duck Congress, would meet. This really made no sense by 1933, you know, regardless of what you thought earlier in our history. And the 20th Amendment got rid of that so that new Congresses now meet in January. The Presidential Disability Amendment raced through. Actually, the 17th Amendment, which is a very important amendment, raced through because the resistance to popular election of senators really was in the Senate itself. But by the time the Senate acquiesced to public opinion and the threat of a constitutional convention, which I'd like to say more about in a few minutes, it then raced through the states because most of the states had, in effect, adopted de facto popular election.
Sandy Levinson, for people who don't know that the 17th Amendment changed the way we elect our senators, we used to select them by state legislatures, and 17th Amendment made it popular election.
And actually, there are those today associated with the Tea Party, or for that matter, Texas Governor Rick Perry, who believed the 17th Amendment was a mistake and should be repealed, and we should go back to selection by state legislatures. But the point in terms of our discussion right now is that it did basically race through. The Equal Rights Amendment is a very, very interesting example of an amendment that was thought to be, you know, a quickly ratified amendment. Something like 32 or 33 states, John would know the exact number because there really is nobody in the country who knows more about constitutional amendment than John Weil. But, you know, a lot of states ratified it very quickly, and then Phyllis Schlafly generated the quite remarkable social movement against the ERA, and as we know, even after a three-year addition to the original seven-year ratification period, it still wasn't successful. But generally speaking, though, you know, I stand ready to be corrected by John, I think that constitutional amendments either succeed fairly quickly or they go down.
John Weil?
He's absolutely right. ERA, if I remember correctly, got up to 35 states, and probably 32 of them, you know, were within the first 6 months, and I'm just pulling that out of thin air. But what I see in the amending process is I don't think that the last 10 years are necessary, or 20 years are necessarily characteristic of, I don't think it's time to do a postmortem on the amending process. If you look at our history, we had 12 that were adopted relatively quickly, two within 2 years of the meeting of the first 10, you know, adopted as a package pretty much in 1791. Then we had a dry spell, 1803 to 1865. And, you know, I think a lot of it during that time is part of the situation now. We really didn't have a consensus on some of the major issues. I mean, we have people very passionately believing that we need campaign limits and others just as passionately believing otherwise. There was a prominent Princeton professor, I suppose still is, who opposed or thought we needed a traditional marriage amendment. We had something similar, you know, 1868 to 1913, we had no amendments, and then we got four amendments adopted in a relatively quick period, you know, reflected the progressive eras. I do get the feeling that there is a rising sort of tide of people who are willing to reconsider the Article 5 convention mechanism. The first book I ever wrote was on proposals to rewrite the Constitution, and I came up, that was in 1991, and I came up with like 40 proposals. I have a book coming out called Reframers, in which I discovered about 175, and the sad thing is I've discovered probably another 20 since the book was written. They seem to be coming out one or two a month now, and some of them, it's titled Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals, and some of them probably fit the eccentric more than they do the visionary. But nonetheless, there are people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum who are, I think, starting to re-examine whether this might be a viable possibility.
John Vile, I think it was in your new book in which you outlined the times in which even presidents were advocating for changing. Sandy Levinson has also talked about in his work where right now we're in this state of it's really not appropriate to criticize the Constitution if you're an elected official, whereas historically we've had elected officials saying we need to make some changes.
Ronald Reagan and Gingrich and, you know, that group, part of what they were advocating, and, you know, sometimes you wonder if they really wanted an amendment or if they preferred to have the issues out there to argue about, but they favored anything from prayer in school to balanced budget and several other proposals.
Stephen Griffin, you looked a lot at the framers as well.
I see the same, roughly the same history that John Vile does through the 19th century. Might disagree, I don't know, on the 20th. Suppose we define contemporary times as roughly the last 100 years. Then we have distinct periods, that's right, where we get a bunch of amendments, and many of the most significant ones are passed in the progressive era. That's where we get not only direct election of senators and votes for women and prohibition, too. But then later on, it seems that the only amendments we pass and the 1960s were themselves a significant period of constitutional change, at least in terms of amendments. But all of them are directed at pretty specific problems, where, as Sandy says, there's a consensus, and so they go through without much trouble. But the big outlier there is the ERA. And I think the ERA bears study because the ERA is the only recent example of an amendment, I'm happy to be corrected, that tried to put a principle into the Constitution rather than solve a specific problem like the problem that Sandy referred to of the date of inauguration. Okay, that's a very specific problem. The ERA was trying to put a principle in the Constitution, and it was doing so at a time when people were very upset, some people, about the activism of the Supreme Court, and people started to think about what would it mean if the Supreme Court, in effect, got a hold of another general principle. So that has, to me, changed the situation. So it's not so easy anymore to think about broad-scale principle change through amendments. And I think Bruce Ackerman, another scholar who's written a lot about the amendment process, is accurate when he says we've got out of the habit of constitutional amendments, talking about them. And if that's true, I think there's a lot of truth to that. The failure of the ERA was a big part of that. When that went down, a lot of the tradition of putting principles in the Constitution that arguably goes back to the Bill of Rights and Reconstruction, that kind of went down too, because any other principles, especially rights principles, would run into the same objection, namely, what's the Supreme Court going to do with that? Now, when I say that there could be a rising tide, I'm really not even talking, though, about principles in terms of rights. I mean, there's just a lot more interest in, we've got a dysfunctional political system, let's try to solve it. But at least that's something that where if the amendment process were foreclosed by it's too difficult, it's a supermajority and all that, there are actually other ways to get at various problems of our political system other than through amendments. So it's not a hopeless quest.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. Stephen Griffin, before we discuss some of these dysfunctions, talk about these informal processes that can produce the kind of change. Obviously, it's not a formal process, but it seems to change the meaning of the Constitution rather than amending the actual Constitution. Would you say that's true?
I'm a big fan of studying informal change. There are certain things, of course, you can only do through amendment. But The filibuster is a really good example. It's a kind of tired example now, but it's a really good example of something that is absolutely not in the Constitution. It's not in the plan. It's really hard to make an argument even that more supermajoritarianism is good for the legislative process when it wasn't part of the plan to begin with. But at the same time, it is a historical practice. It's lasted a long time. So it's an institutional practice that suddenly changes. Because of changes in the political system, it metastasizes. It becomes much more significant than it ever was, and its very nature changes. It's not about Mr. Smith, Jimmy Stewart, you know, standing up and talking for 24 hours until he collapses. It's really an institutional change in the Senate where both sides are agreed, yeah, we're agreeing that you absolutely need 60 votes to move anything. And yet this happens without any public discussion. But that is a vulnerability for the people who like this. There are people who think that it's a good idea to have that kind of supermajoritarian principle. I don't obviously think it's a good idea at all, but that's a really good example of a pressure point where if you got rid of it, a significant difference would result, and you can get rid of it without a constitutional amendment.
Sandy Levinson.
I think that your listeners ought to know that there is a very, very active campaign occurring throughout the country to generate an Article 5 constitutional convention through the petition of the states. When people think of Article 5, they almost invariably think of two-thirds of the Senate and the House and then three-quarters of the states, but two-thirds of each House of Congress, because that, in fact, is how all the 27 amendments got to the states in the first place. But Article 5 very deliberately includes another pathway to proposal, which is through a constitutional convention that is called on petition of two-thirds of the states. There's an active campaign underway, largely dominated by political conservatives who want a balanced budget amendment. And they believe, quite correctly, that there is no real prospect of a balanced budget amendment getting through the Senate. The high point of that possibility was in the 1980s when they actually got two-thirds minus one. Mark Hatfield, Republican senator from Oregon, voted against the proposal, and it didn't go to the states. I think most people believe that the current Congress would not, in fact, propose an amendment. But John might know the actual number of states who have filed petitions for an Article 5 convention. Now, it opens a huge Pandora's box of legal questions. Do all the states have to agree on every dotted I and crossed T on what the petition says? Most importantly, can states call for a limited convention that could consider only a balanced budget amendment, or would any convention be as open as the 1787 convention was to put everything on the table? My own view is that any convention is an unlimited convention. That doesn't bother me as much as it bothers most of my friends and family. But I can tell you that if we ever get to the 34th state that agrees that there ought to be a new convention for the purpose of considering a balanced budget amendment, then there would instantly be discussion and perhaps even litigation on whether the convention could be limited. And a number of the petitions, I believe, very explicitly say that the state legislature supports a new convention if and only if it can be limited. But this is going on right now. There are significant, substantial people, and I think money, being devoted to it. And I will say that as a person who doesn't share the conservative politics, I actually am kind of rooting this on, because I think it would be very good to shake up public opinion and public discussion by having to discuss whether we need some genuinely fundamental change in the constitutional system. But don't forget state petitions. Congress might be hopeless, but state legislatures could turn out to be very, very interesting political actors in the next year or two.
John Weil.
I really appreciate my colleagues and how complimentary they've been. I actually disagree with Sandy in believing that we could have a limited convention, although there are a lot of ifs, ands, and buts and a lot of complications. One thing that I think is interesting that maybe is even under the radar of what we're seeing, although the balanced budget is sort of the tip of the spear in the calls for conventions, I have found it surprising how many people also really want to reconfigure federalism. And, of course, many people would argue that what they're trying to do is get back to the founders. But, I mean, there are proposals that Supreme Court justices from the states could, within a year, revoke federal legislation. There are any number of proposals like that that are also part of this movement. And I do think that it's a fairly strong movement. That being said, we've had at least three occasions on history where we got close and didn't do it. And one was the 17th Amendment, and some people think it was one of the prompts for Congress. But then there was a similar movement in the 1960s in reaction to the reapportionment decision. And then, as Sandy says, you know, particularly right now, the balanced budget and other federal concerns are very prominent.
You've all mentioned the states and the actions that the states can take. I know that some states and cities have been passing resolutions along these lines. The state of California passed a resolution, I think, supporting a constitutional amendment to try to overturn the Supreme Court opinion via constitutional amendment. Is this significant at all, Sandy?
I got in the mail an issue of the Arkansas Law Review that published a lecture that I gave on what I call neo-nullification, and for that matter, neo-secessionism, that is alive and well in the United States today. By neo-nullification, I mean attempts by state legislatures in particular, but also some city councils, to do whatever they can to make enforcement of federal law impossible. Some of them quite grandiosely, and I think altogether implausibly, believe that they do have the authority genuinely to nullify a federal law, and I think that's nonsense. But Heather Gerken, who teaches at the Yale Law School, coined the term uncooperative federalism, which I think is a wonderful term because it gets at the reality that the modern American state depends for its effective administration on the willingness of states and localities to be part of the same governmental team. And to the extent that, well, my own city of Austin is considering a proposal, which I frankly support, to stop cooperating with federal immigration authorities with regard to holding illegal aliens who have been arrested for a traffic violation or something else, so that the federal authorities can round them up and then deport them. New Orleans, where Steve lives, I think also has engaged in the same kind of resistance. It's not what John Calhoun would have called nullification, but I think that this is an important aspect of contemporary politics where at times it really is hard to tell the players without a scorecard in terms of traditional left-right divisions, that on gun policy, it's the right wing that wants to declare that federal gun laws are unenforceable. But with regard to immigration policy, you are discovering that there are some people associated with the left who say, now, wait a minute, we should do whatever we can to torpedo federal legislation that the Supreme Court no doubt believes is perfectly constitutional.
Stephen Griffin.
The common pattern here is that because of dysfunction, gridlock, whatever you want to call it, at the national level, there's a lot of policy ferment going on in the states. And immigration is a really good example of where it maybe trends a little liberal out of frustration of non-action. But a lot of it is conservative, and you didn't have, let's say, a big budget agreement getting us back on the road, let's say, to surpluses. and that just feeds discontent at the state level. Now, people do have this outlet, and it's a good outlet, and I don't actually think we would face a runaway convention. My thinking on that has shifted a little bit. But, you know, people in Washington need to pay attention to this.
John Vile.
I did not know about this example from Austin, but it reminds me of, we always associate federalism with the Southern cause, but long before federalism, we had the Hartford Convention, you know, where the New England states were considering moving away. And we also had, you know, many northern states who were very reluctant, understandably, to enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause. So this is not a new phenomenon. If we go back to the founders' intentions, when you read through the debates at the Constitutional Convention, the interesting thing about the Article 5 Convention is that it was when they almost got through and they had a proposal essentially where amendments would all depend on Congress. And George Mason and others said, of course, they didn't have experience in knowing what the new Congress was going to do. But, you know, what if it turns out to be tyrannical? Are we going to leave them, you know, with all power? And the Article 5 amending process or the convention process from right or left does indicate that if Congress is unresponsive, and, you know, this is a lesson for them, if they are unresponsive, there are alternate means that can be used.
Stephen Griffin, John Vile, Sanford Levinson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism from Theory to Politics. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.